welcome to the New in Chess podcast. You are listening to a story from The Essential Sosonko, collected portraits and tales of a bygone chess era by Grandmaster Genna Sosonko. Since the 1980s, Sosonko has written extensively for New in Chess magazine. His chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. Today's episode is about José Raúl Capablanca. Having beaten Emmanuel Lasker in 1921, Capablanca became the third world chess champion. His positional insights are still widely praised, and he is still considered to be one of the most influential chess players of all time. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy, from The Essential Sosonko, Chapter 7, José Raúl Capablanca.
I knew Capablanca. In 1989, in the Spanish town of Murcia, I was chatting with a young player from the Soviet Union. "You once saw 11 fish," he asked in surprise. "And did you also see Schiffers?" He asked this so sincerely that to this day I'm not sure whether he was joking, since the young have their own impression of time, which is defined by a capacious phrase, "long ago." After thinking briefly, I replied that I had not known Schiffers, who died in 1904. I also did not know Capablanca, who died a year before I was born, but in a way I have seen him close to his habits, his way of speaking and dressing, of playing bridge and of staying silent. In 1984, in New York, I met for the first time with Capablanca's widow, Olga Clark, and now, examining the notes of those years, hearing her voice recorded on tape and travelling back in time, I see people who have long been gone, and in particular, Capablanca himself. The more that I immersed myself ever more deeply in the atmosphere of that time and in his life, there increasingly came to mind a thought, similar to that expressed by Reagan at one of the Republican Party conventions. "Democrats often like to quote Jefferson. I knew Jefferson." I made the acquaintance of Olga on May 6, 1984, in the Manhattan Chess Club, which was then housed on the 10th floor of Carnegie Hall. That day, as she had already done many times, she was presenting to the club something out of Capablanca's personal effects. I saw a very elderly woman, of American-style indeterminate age, with permed hair, strong traces of cosmetics on her face, and sparkling rings on fingers touched by the pigmentation of old age. We introduced ourselves, and I gave my name.
"Sorry, what did you say?"
she asked me again.
"Snosko. Snosko?"
I again repeated my name.
"Sorry,"
she said, smiling.
"I've never heard of you. But did you know Snosko Borovsky?"
Footnote, E.A. Snosko Borovsky, 1884 to 1954, Russian chess player and journalist, emigrated to France in 1917, end footnote.
"He was a friend of Capablanca, and we often used to meet him in Paris."
After the initial words of acquaintance, we switched to Russian, and later we would always speak in this language. She was Russian by birth, spoke the language quite well, and had even published a collection of poems, which, however, were very feeble. Occasionally, in her speech, she would insert French sayings and words, and more rarely, Anglicisms. Although her speech was free of words such as appointment or experience, with Russian endings attached, which one so often encounters in the language of the latest emigration of Russian Americans, sometimes she would openly ask,
"How do you say this in Russian?"
She was called Olga Clark, Clark being the surname of her last husband. She readily agreed to a meeting and dinner the following evening in the Russian tea room. Precisely at 4, I was standing at the door of an enormous house on the corner of 68th Street and Park Avenue, a highly prestigious region of Manhattan.
"Who would you like to see?" asked a porter in livery. "Ah, Mrs. Clark. Bill, would you please show this gentleman up to the 7th floor?
She was already standing by an outsized door.
Come in, please. I'm sorry, you have a very difficult surname. I've forgotten it.
Within a short time, we began addressing each other by our first names. Having the alternatives, Mrs. Clark, which somehow did not fit with the topic of our conversation, Madame, which for some reason I did not try, Mrs. Capablanca Clark, which sounded rather clumsy, and the altogether Russian, Olga Evgenievna. I settled, with her permission, on Olga, remembering the young Vanderweil, who, to my surprise, called the 75-year-old Erva simply Max, and explained to me, he enjoys it. Otherwise it's always, yes, Mr. Erva, no, Mr. Erva. We settled down in the lounge. The windows were slightly open, and the noise of cars carried up from Park Avenue, as is recorded on my tape.
What shall we drink?
She asked. Beside the divan stood a drinks trolley, but on seeing my wandering gaze, she herself suggested,
champagne, perhaps? Let's call Bill. He'll open a bottle for us. Well, now, what did you want to ask me about Capablanca? Yes, you may record it on tape.
In our conversations, she always called him Capablanca or Capa, but never Raoul or Jose, forms of address which often occurred in letters to him, which she bequeathed to the Manhattan Chess Club. As did many personal forms, for example in Spanish, Mi querido Capablanca, or strictly official ones listing all his titles, or the gentle My dear Capablanca, Erva's invariable form of address. I did not venture to ask about her age, although it was evident that she had long since reached that age when one takes pride in one's years rather than hides them. It used to be thought that she had been born in 1900. It was only after her death that I learned the exact date of her birth. Olga Evgenievna Chubarova was born in the Caucasus on September 23, 1898. At the time of our meeting, she was not far short of 86 years old.
My first husband's surname was Shagodayev. He was an officer in the White Army, a cavalryman. Altogether, I have been married 4 times. My last husband was Admiral Clark. He was a remarkable man. Before him, I was married to a man who was much younger than me, an Olympic champion at, how do you say it in Russian? Rowing? Practically everything that I have now came from him, but I'd rather not talk about that.
In our conversation, she should occasionally make use of this formula, and I, naturally, never insisted.
Well, and of course, Capablanca. What can I tell you about him? When did we meet? Oh, it was exactly 50 years ago, here in New York, in the spring of 1934. There was some party at the house of the Cuban consul. I was unwell and looked awful, but my sister simply dragged me there. Ah, you know, New York was different then, lively and altogether. You probably don't know that it was I, not Marlene Dietrich, who brought the black veil into fashion. However, what significance does all that have now? She sighed.
Do you see? That's me.
Looking at me from the opposite wall was a dazzling beauty, a blonde with dark brown eyes. Well, of course, I recognise you straight away.
Ah, Dushka.
Her knobbly hand touched mine. Later, too, she would occasionally call me by this Russian word, hard to translate, the overtones of which can be found in the English word, darling.
So it was at this party that I met Capablanca. What was he like? You must understand. He was a king, and in every way he conducted himself like a king. When, before some simultaneous display, someone asked them to point out Capablanca, they said to him, "When they all enter the hall, you yourself will see who is Capablanca." In Belgium, Capablanca was at a diplomatic reception, and being a diplomat, he had to be presented to the Belgian king. A minister later told me that, when the king heard Capablanca's name, he ran up to Capa like a child, which was contrary to all protocol. The king showered him with compliments. I know your games, and now what an honour I am seeing you in person.
He was liked by everyone, and he had good relations with everyone, except, of course, Alyakin. I first saw Alyakin somewhere near Carlsbad. I think it was in 36. It was summer, and there was some party in a garden. I was talking with Stahlberg, who Kappa had just introduced me to, but a few minutes later we were approached by some man with dishevelled hair who looked like a shop salesman. It was Alyakin. Was he attractive? Oh, on the contrary, he was rather unsavoury. I immediately recognised him from photographs. Capablanca's sworn enemy, and I froze on the spot. He introduced himself.
I am Alyakin. You must excuse us, he said to Stahlberg. I have to say something private to Madame.
Alyakin took me to the end of the garden. I can still see the tomato beds along which we walked, and he began speaking very determinedly. He said that Capablanca can think what he likes about him, but in company they must greet each other. That Capablanca did not even bow to him, and so on. Evidently, I replied, Capablanca has strong reasons for this.
Perhaps, said Alyakin, but the whole world understands that although I lost the match to Erva and he is now the official world champion, it is myself and Capablanca who are the strongest players.
Capablanca and you, I said, and you know this, and that is why you do not give Capablanca a return match. He looked at me strangely and continued,
I was not altogether well during my match with Erva, but I can assure you that...
Again I interrupted him. Just as Capablanca was not well when he gave up his title to you in 1927 in Buenos Aires.
C'est impossible de parler avec vous. Vous êtes un tigresse,
said Alyakin, and I never again spoke to him. Yes, in French and in Russian. We switched from one language to the other and rushed along the beds shouting at each other. Do you know, I said to Capablanca when I came back, Alyakin has just called me a tigress, and I retold the whole conversation to him.
Ah, you are my tigress, Capablanca said, and he kissed my hand.
Later I told him all this again. He did not want to miss a single detail. When I arrived in Nottingham, that day Kappa won against Alyakin and was happy. It was there that he asked me what impression Alyakin made on me. It seems to me, I said, that if you were to pinch him, he would squeal, whereas another man would roar.
You are indeed a little tigress, Kappa said.
There in Nottingham, he said to me,
I hate Alyakin.
We spoke almost always in French, and we only swore at each other in English. But we did this quite often because I was always late. Kappa spoke both French and English wonderfully. Did he speak Russian? He knew a few words, but I will not tell you which.
A smile appeared on her face, but even looking more closely, it was not easy to recognise in her the beauty with the flaxen hair, who, with her bewitching smile, was still looking at us. At this moment, a man of close on 60 came into the room.
This is my friend, said Olga.
We introduced ourselves and said a few appropriate words. He asked how long I would be staying in New York, and the three of us drank champagne together. A few minutes later, he asked us to excuse him and bowed.
The Baron is a very decent man, although he is of German origin, said Olga,
once again switching to Russian when he had left.
Well now, what else can I tell you about Capablanca? Once in Paris, in the Regina Hotel, Tartakova came to visit us. I was unwell and was in bed. Tartakova was very nice, and Kappa greatly valued his opinions. So there they were, sitting by my bed, when Tartakova suddenly said,
Why don't we have a game of chess?
Here I should say that Kappa never played chess privately. How do you say in Russian, at home? At least that was the case when I was there. But I do not think that even in his youth he ever played privately. But here Kappa agreed, and he recorded this game. He won, then folded the sheet, handed it to me, and said,
"This is for you. Some day this will be a beautiful diamond."
"How do you mean?" I asked.
"This is how, since the time that I was a child, my slightest movement has been recorded, represented, or advertised. But no one has seen this game."
I had forgotten about this, but recently I was looking for something for the Capablanca Museum in the Manhattan Club when I came across it. But I gave them something else and I kept it. Now I want to sell it. For what amount? I think $10,000. I see big money being paid for typescripts and manuscripts. And do you know, this is a very rare thing, like a new Mozart symphony. What do you think? They begged me from Cuba for part of the Capablanca archives, but I never even replied to them. No, I did not know Nimzowitsch and Rubinstein. They were before my time. But Lasker I remember very well. He conducted himself with the dignity of an old lion. Botvinnik and his wife behaved modestly and kept rather aloof. Kappa was on good terms with them and forecast that someday Botvinnik would become world champion. Yes, of course, I also remember Erva very well. He was an impeccable gentleman, but somehow rather insipid. Savieli Tartakova was our friend. Yes, I used to speak with him in Russian, but when the three of us were together, we spoke in French, of course. In appearance, he was unattractive, long nose, round face, and bald, but infinitely charming, sincere, and generous. But most of all, Kappa was disposed to English people. He was an Anglophile, Dr. Tyler, who could hardly see anything, but possessed an amazing wit and impeccable manners. Alexander, young, handsome, enthusiastic. I remember them very well. But most of all, Capablanca was disposed to Sir George Thomas. It can be said that they were close friends, although it was a very special friendship. They would sit in silence, only occasionally exchanging the odd remark. This surprised me, but both of them seemed very content with each other. On the whole, Sir George spoke little with anyone, apart from Capablanca. He was very well educated, and spoke with a slow dignity. In general, in his behaviour and manners, Capablanca belonged to the English upper classes, and what is characteristic is that he was completely indifferent to his fame. Later, in his papers, I found invitations to highly prestigious English houses, highly prestigious. On the whole, he was an introvert, although sometimes he liked to have people around him, but only sometimes. By nature, he was taciturn, and back home in Havana, they said that the young Raoul thought that he had gold in his mouth, which he was afraid of squandering. But when he flew into a rage, it was like a hurricane, although he would calm down fairly quickly, and then he would say, "It must be difficult for you living with a man of such a character as mine, but that is the way I am." The greatest compliment I received from him was when he once said, "You know, I am so sick and tired of all this that I must go away immediately somewhere into the mountains with no one around." I replied, "Well, I'll go and pack your suitcase," and I quickly got things ready. He asked,
"But where is yours?"
"But you wanted to go away on your own."
"No, Kikiriki, you are part of me. I meant that there should be only you and me."
He sometimes called me this, Kikiriki, an amusing nickname taken from a French song. That was how, in my childhood back in Tiflis, my governess called me. I am, after all, the great-granddaughter of Evdokimov, the famous conqueror of the Caucasus, subjugator of Shamil. In our family, all the male line were soldiers. Kappa could spend hours reading books on military strategy, but even so, his favourite reading, apart from detective stories, was books on history and philosophy. He never read, how do you say in Russian, fiction. Before a game, he would most often read. No, he never took a nap. "Oh, no, what do you mean you haven't tired me out at all? Perhaps another bottle? Go on, I'll call Bill."
We went out into the corridor. On the wall directly opposite the lounge hung a picture of some people in naval uniform.
"That is my last husband, Admiral Clark," said Olga, pointing to one of them. "He was a war hero and a friend of MacArthur. You will have heard the name of Admiral Clark."
I made a gesture which could be interpreted in various ways. More than anything, it approached the biblical, "Thou sayest it."
"Come on, I'll show you something else."
We went quite a considerable distance down the corridor and stopped by an open door. At the back of the room sat a very big man who was eating something and reading a paper. I instinctively took a step back.
"You can speak loudly, he won't hear anything. This is Fish, Congressman Hamilton Fish. He is 96 and was named in honour of Alexander Hamilton. That is his grandfather sitting on the knee of George Washington."
She pointed at a picture hanging on the wall, in the centre of which, on the knee of a person with a face familiar from its depiction on the dollar note, sat a little boy. I imperceptibly leaned my arm against the doorpost. The champagne, in combination with this live excursion into the history of the United States, was having its effect.
"You know, he is a terrible miser, although his family is one of the oldest and richest in America, older than the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. He used to be very strong, and in 1914 was judged the best player in American football."
The man did not pay any attention to us and turned over the page of his newspaper.
"He married my sister, and I married Admiral Clark, and we bought this apartment. Effectively, there are two apartments, joined by a corridor. He has a little dog, and I have a cat. You know, Kappa loved cats, and in the last year we had a wonderful cat, which he often used to play with."
There involuntarily came to mind Alyakin's Siamese beauty with the nickname Chess, but I had the sense to keep silent, realizing the inappropriateness of such a remark.
"And so he and I lived together like cat and dog," sighed Olga.
I learned later that Congressman Fish had been a prominent figure in American politics over a long period of time. He was remembered, among other things, for a fierce clash with President Roosevelt. A staunch Republican, he lived to the age of 101, and just a few days before his death, he made a passionate speech against his own grandson, who was standing for Congress for the Democratic Party. A few years before his death, he married a woman of just over 50. It need hardly be said that this fact in no way improved the relations between Olga and the congressman. For every year that they lived together, his wife received, according to Olga, $1 million. His act was also greeted without enthusiasm by the congressman's children, although again, according to Olga, his estate could in no way have suffered from this good-for-nothing. A few minutes later, in the lounge, Bill opened a new bottle of champagne.
"Sante," I said.
She raised her glass.
"A la bonne vôtre. Now, where did we get to?"
"Did he like alcohol?" I asked, not altogether appropriately.
"Champagne, or if wine, then a little, and definitely only good wine. It was only after I met him that I began to understand wine. He was a gourmet. He only ate a little, and when they brought large portions, he waved his hands. But everything definitely had to be of excellent quality. On occasions, he would send a dish back, but he was forgiven for everything, and everyone liked him. Sometimes he himself would prepare something from a Cuban recipe, and he was good at this, provided, of course, that it didn't get burned. I, myself, always used to squeeze orange juice for him. It had to be through a linen cloth, in case, God forbid, anything should fall into the glass, for he was very capricious. He was generous, and he liked to entertain friends, for that is how we lived. Live now and pay later. Regarding his clothes, he was the same. He had few things, but everything that he had was of the very best quality. He was always splendidly dressed. Even the English newspapers wrote about this. The most elegantly dressed chess player. But he used to dress, how do you say in Russian, sober, classically, severely? Perhaps. That was his taste. He always ordered his suits from one and the same tailor on Savile Row for many years, and sometimes he would make purchases on Bond Street. Ties were his weakness,
and he himself used to tie them very carefully. He especially liked one tie that I gave him as a present. No, he was not superstitious, although he used to wear it for important games. That's the way he was about everything, you understand. He was a perfectionist. He was an excellent tennis player, and his trainers said that if he had played seriously, he could have been one of the best. He was a simply splendid driver. He called for me in his car the evening after we had first met. He very much liked playing billiards, and I heard that if he had devoted more time to billiards, he could have become a champion. I know that when he was young and studying at Columbia University, he was invited to play in the main baseball league, but that was way before my time. Well, and of course, bridge. He was an excellent player, and even champions came to him for advice. I was a much weaker player, roughly the same as Keres, but Vera Menchik played very well. I remember her. We used to speak in Russian. And one more thing, he was extraordinarily proud. It was in his blood. I only once saw him shower someone with compliments. It was an old, roguish florist in Havana. He sold us some flowers that were not fresh, and I got very angry and protested, and Kappa apologized profusely and bowed to him, like I had never seen. Yes, an old, toothless Cuban florist. When we visited Cuba, we always stayed at the same hotel, because the owner was a friend of Kappa. Cuba was then a delightful country, lively, with frequent carnivals, dancers, music, a mass of flowers, and there was altogether no poverty. Kappa liked being there, but not for too long. In general, he was restless. He liked to travel. It was in his blood. London, of course, was his city. He liked England most of all. But there was also Paris. I recall that in Paris in 1937, there was a reception at the Cuban consulate in honour of von Ribbentrop. He was a very charming man, and he danced with me all evening. At the end, he invited me to Germany. But I am a Slav, and after all, you don't much like Slavs. Besides, you already have Olga Chekhovka, I said. He paid me a shower of compliments, said that if the Führer were to see me, he would without fail fall in love, and I would be Queen of Germany. Why should I want to be Queen of Germany, I replied, when I am now Queen of the World? Kappa, who was standing alongside, beamed all over his face. Yes, of course I remember Amsterdam. There was the hotel on the waterfront. Yes, the Amstel. I also remember the seagulls over the water. But you know, Kappa should never have played in that tournament. He was not at all prepared for it. He had private problems with his divorce. And the main thing, he was ill, very ill. He had enormous fluctuations in his blood pressure, which would sometimes rise terribly high. It ran in their family. His father died from it, as did his son recently in Cuba. During the game with Botvinnik, at the end of the tournament, he felt unwell. Later, he told me that in the toilet he had nearly lost consciousness. His doctor Gomez strongly advised against him playing in that tournament, since Kappa should have avoided the slightest excitement. But at the time, I could not even imagine how serious it was.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.